What's up, everyone? This is Anthony Pompliano. Most of you know me as Pomp. You're listening to Off the Chain, simply the best podcast in crypto. Let's kick this thing off.
CZ is the founder and CEO of Binance, a company with 400 employees and hundreds of millions of dollars in profit. In this conversation, we discuss what he understood when he started the company that many others didn't, how he scaled, and what their future plans are. I'm a big fan of the work that he's done, and I think that Binance and CZ are some of the best executors in the crypto industry. I hope you enjoy this conversation nearly as much as I did.
Before we get started, I want to talk about one of our sponsors, The Grove. As many of you know, branding and online presence is crucial to the crypto space. With so many damn scams out there, it's tough to tell who's legit. The Grove, however, is a full-service creative and design agency that will help you amplify your brand with the perfect website, logo, collateral, or custom design project. Branding isn't just about looking pretty, though, like me. The Grove understands it's about driving revenue. If you want to check out what they're doing, you can go to thegrove.co/pomp. Again, that's thegrove.co, not .com. CO, new age stuff. thegrove.co/pomp. Let's crash their servers and light up the webpage. Let me know when you do it, and I'll shoot you some fire emojis on Twitter. thegrove.co/pomp.
Anthony Pompliano is a partner at Morgan Creek Digital. All opinions expressed by Pomp or his guests on this podcast are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of Morgan Creek Digital or Morgan Creek Capital Management. You should not treat any opinion expressed by Pomp as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of his opinion. This podcast is for informational purposes only.
All right, guys, I'm super excited. I've got CZ from Binance. We've got a whole bunch of stuff to cover. But first, sir, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Pam. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. I think almost everybody in crypto knows you as the CEO of Binance, but you've got a pretty interesting background beforehand. Maybe just talk about some of the stuff you did before you started Binance.
Sure. So I was born in China, went to Canada when I was a teenager, did high school and college in Canada. And then I worked in Tokyo, New York, and then Hong Kong, Shanghai, and now everywhere. So that kind of gave you the sort of where I traveled kind of background. I've always been I used to be a programmer. So I was computer science, C++ programmer, and then I was always working in the financial field. So in Tokyo, I worked for a subcontractor of a software company that programmed some stuff for the Tokyo Stock Exchange. And then in New York, I worked for Bloomberg, mostly on their futures trading products. I was leading a development team that covered everything to do with Bloomberg Tradebook Futures when it first started. So I was the first team that started that group. And then I went back to Asia to start my own business. And again, still always in trading systems. So I got into crypto in 2013-ish. And then I think the rest is kind of the history, yeah.
And do you feel like a lot of the living in different places, working at different companies, that's helped in terms of the way that you view building Binance today?
Oh, I think absolutely. I think both from the fact that when you travel through different countries, you realize that one currency is limited to one country. This is very different from a large percent of the population where they think that their local currency is the money. Whereas you kind of view that as a different piece of paper. So that kind of shifts the mentality a little bit. It also helps tremendously for Binance to have the international reach and position. So traveling between different countries, I kind of always adopted the mentality, we're one world. We're not focused on one country, one geographic location. So it does have a lot of impact. Sometimes even less clear than that. Sometimes it's more subtle, but it does have an impact.
For sure. And I guess really, you know, a lot of people obviously know about everything that's going on now, but it's not like you just stumbled into crypto a year and a half, 2 years ago, right? I mean, you've been around for quite a while. Maybe talk a little bit about when you first discovered Bitcoin and the broader crypto industry and some of that early stuff like the conferences, some of those stories.
Sure, sure. So the first time I heard about Bitcoin was when I was hosting a poker game in my house in Shanghai, when Bobby Lee and Ron Cao was playing. So Bobby Lee is the CEO of BTC China. He was just about to join BTC China. And that's when the conversation came up. I was like, well, if he's going to do that, and then Ron Cao, Lightspeed, is going to pump $5 million into it, this is sort of mid-2013. I better learn what it is, right? So I Googled Bitcoin and read the white paper. And for me, actually, the white paper was relatively easy to understand. I didn't understand a lot of the mathematics, but I had my private keys, PGP private keys, since 1998. So I kind of understand how asymmetric encryption works. And I've always worked in the financial industry, so I kind of know how finances work, kind of at least at some high level. So it's quite easy for me to understand, and I immediately see the utility of it. And then I think it was like December 2013, I went to Vegas for a conference. I met with Vitalik, Matt Rozek, Brock Pierce, Charlie Lee, all the same crew. And I said, well, if this is the community back then they were not famous. They were just all regular guys at a conference. But I kind of liked the community. So after that conference, I came back and told my boss, I'm going to leave and I'm going to do something crypto. And so that's how I started, really. So that's 2013.
And then what was that first thing you did? Because it wasn't to start Binance.
No. So Bobby and I had talked about me joining BTC China, like maybe a technology or CTO type of role. But somehow I bumped into Roger Ver, and he's the biggest owner or shareholder of blockchain.info. So I ended up joining blockchain.info as the third guy. But there were some blockchain.info. I was the third guy in, together with Nicholas Carey and the original founder, Ben Reeves. And then we grew the team to 18 people. I learned a lot of stuff from there. So blockchain.info back then was also a company that no offices, no bank accounts, and of the 18 people that we built, they were spread out around, I don't know, like 12 countries. So very similar to Binance today. But then the company took a different direction. They took venture capital and everything else. I left just before that to join OKCoin, which is a Chinese-based exchange, which basically morphed into OKEX today. So OKCoin was on exchanges, which fits my tech background much more. There were some value system differences, or the way we do things that's different. And I left after about less than a year. Then I started my own startup building technology platforms, exchange trading platforms for other exchanges. And this is a cloud solution where if you pay a fee and point your domain into an IP address we give you, then you have your exchange system. So we did that for 30 exchanges, and quite a number of them are not in the crypto space, actually. In 2013, a regulator shut down most of our clients, so we lost a lot of that business. And we said, "Well, let's do crypto to crypto." So that's how we started Binance, and it kind of worked out.
Yeah, to say it worked out is an understatement, my friend. So maybe talk about when you started Binance. My understanding is that it was you and a very small group of others. And you were actually building the initial product. Is that correct?
Yes. So basically, when we started Binance, I had a team of about 30 people. I think 33 or 34 people back then. We were all crammed into one very small space in Shanghai. But we had the product already. We had most of the product already. We had to do some stuff on the deposit withdrawal security side, etc. But we had like 90% of the product. So we did an ICO. From the time we finished the ICO to launching the product took us 12 days. So we finished the ICO on July 2nd, 2017, and launched it on July 14th, 2017. So we had a small but very dedicated team, and that helped a lot.
Yeah, I mean that's incredible speed, and it's funny because as you and I have talked. The early days of Binance, a lot of those same ethos or the approach to building technology, even though you've now scaled to many, many more employees all around the world, a lot of that still applies in terms of the speed that you guys are able to move at and kind of the way that you approach building products.
Yes, absolutely. So the original team, there's almost no one left. Everyone's still here. And they're all quite wealthy as well, at least on paper. So, so we kept that team. The culture from the early days filtered throughout the organization. Now, we don't have long term plans. We have like weekly plans, and every week we'll get some stuff done. So we're still on that very fast pace. Even though now, given a larger, more decentralized team, there's more overhead on communication. But I still push things very, very hard, and things get done very quickly. So we still move forward very, very fast.
Absolutely. And what do you think that you knew in those early days, right? And early days is literally what? I think you guys are like 18 months old now, right?
Yeah.
Right. So what do you think you knew then that maybe other exchanges or other entrepreneurs didn't know or maybe didn't put as much importance on that you did?
I think basically when we started, there was Bittrex and Poloniex who were doing crypto to crypto only. Most of the other guys are still focused on fiat. And everybody viewed fiat as the bigger market. And that's true. The market potential is bigger. But what people missed was the crypto to crypto, you can go international. Right? So you can have a small market in each country, but you can do 180 countries. And even Poloniex and Bittrex kind of missed this in the early days because they were focused on the US market. They only had an English interface. They only had a web interface. They didn't have a mobile apps back then. So they kind of missed the international aspects. We want a little bit of... So basically, back then, the crypto-to-crypto market is relatively new. All the guys trading it are advanced crypto users because basically you got to have Bitcoin to buy some other coin, and that's the user using us. So those other guys missed the international aspects of it. So I think Binance is probably one of the very few companies, or at least one of the earliest companies that grown simultaneously in 180 different countries. So that's never done before. So most of the mentality before was, let me target the US market. Let me conquer the US market first, and then we'll move to China, and then we'll move to India, and then we'll move to Europe. So that's kind of the mentality. Whereas given the blockchain aspect of it now, there's no borders. You can grow in many countries at once. I think that's early days. That's one of the key benefactors for us growing quickly.
Yeah, this idea that the blockchain allows for a world without borders is fascinating to me. As you were building Binance, what would you say were the biggest challenges, right? Because obviously there was the regulation challenge, but other than that, what else were those challenges in the early days that maybe people don't know that you guys faced?
So, regulatory space is very challenging for when you're growing in 180 different countries because theoretically there's 100 different, slightly different variations of regulations going on. And also in our industry, to be honest, the regulations are still unclear in most of those countries, or probably in all of those countries to some extent. That's always challenging. So you don't want to step on somebody's toes. So you don't want to violate something, but then the rules are not clear. So what you do and what you cannot do are a little bit fuzzy. So you have to have a very strong moral compass. You have to have a very strong ethical values, and as the team gets bigger, we got to make sure that the ethical values are inherited in every person. So we got to hire people very carefully to have that value. So that's probably the biggest challenge we have. It's basically getting the team right. And once you have the team with those kind of values, then things become a lot easier. Other difficulties are more tactical. It's like, okay, communication. We have as the team growing, we have a lot of communication issues. We didn't have any system to facilitate it. Everything was done either by chat or like a Google Doc. But those challenges are more tactical. They're not very strategic. There are multiple ways to overcome them, and eventually you do.
Yeah. So let's dig in a little bit about the kind of the organizational structure of Binance, because I don't think a lot of people actually realize. You know, you went from 30 people all literally in a room to today. How many employees? How many different countries are they in? Maybe just talk a little bit about that structure that you have that's so unique to what you guys are doing.
Sure. So so today we have 400, exactly 400 people, actually. So we've grown about 10 times in about 10x in terms of headcount in about 18 months. And that's very challenging to deal with. And also we're spread out around, like, I think, 43 different countries the last time we counted. So the way we organize ourselves, and the only way we could organize ourselves, is basically have very small teams, and they're very independent, they're very autonomous. So very often I find out things afterwards, after they're live, they're done. And we're like, okay, that feature's already done and it's already live. So it's a fairly decentralized organization. Now we have some mechanism to share status across groups or across teams. And now the teams who have to cooperate with each other more often, for example, the marketing team kind of needs to interface with everybody. And now it's kind of slowly grown. The processes are sort of a more fluid now. But there were times where the marketing team were pushing out stuff that the tech team doesn't know about, or vice versa. So we had a lot of those issues. But what we did is, because we have people who are very passionate and they all work very hard on themselves, that overcame a lot of the issues. And we had, so basically we just give them a lot of freedom. They decide what the best thing to do. Eventually they figure out how to cooperate with the other teams, how to communicate, what tools we use, et cetera. So I mean, I can get into a lot of details, but there are so many problems as well. For example, we have so many different chat groups, so many different chat tools, and that's a constant distraction. How to deal with that is another issue. Again, that's no perfect solution, so we kind of deal with it.
Yeah, it fascinates me because there's so much talk in Silicon Valley specifically about distributed teams versus not distributed teams. And not only have you guys made it work at scale with 400 employees, but you've done it in such a short period of time, right? It's the way I think about it is the faster that you grow a distributed team, the more stress you put on everything from the communication to the systems, the management, et cetera. And you guys, although there's been those challenges, have not only kept it together, but frankly, the company has thrived while you've been scaling that employee base.
I think it's very, I think we got lucky in a lot of fronts where we have what's called there's a term for it, a massive transformative mission or something. So yep. We got a mission that's meaningful and that's very impactful and people want to contribute to that. And that's something, I think as long as people working on something that's meaningful and impactful, I think that's much stronger than paying them a little bit like 20% more, 50% more. So I think that helped us a lot. And actually some of the external difficulties we face actually unites us. So when there's an external war going on, the team unites together and try to fight that war. And that kind of overlooks the small differences or small problems within the team. So we actually faced a lot of external challenges. So I think just keeping the team busy on external challenges and getting things done really fast helps a lot. And at the end of the day, I think we're doing a really meaningful thing. And everybody on the team knows that. And so I think that helps overcoming a lot of the issues that we're facing. But at the end of the day, we're still having a lot of the issues. We're still having a lot of the growing pains. And there's no, it's not a secret. So,
but for sure,
it's working. Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I've heard you say before is that, you know, finance isn't going to necessarily be the highest paying employer. And actually, a lot of people will take a pay cut to come work with you guys. You know, one, talk a little bit more about that. And then two, maybe talk about how do you describe that world-changing mission to the employees internally?
Sure. So, almost all employees, we don't really use the word employees, but we use more of team members. We view ourselves as one team. And the concept of a company is kind of virtual anyway. But so most people do take a pay cut to join us. And then the good performers, we compensate them in other ways. And usually when they first join, they will most definitely take a pay cut. And if they do well, we can adjust over time. So that definitely happens. And we look for people who are very passionate about this industry. And we look for people who are already understanding this industry already. So luckily, Binance has a really good brand reputation out there. So it's quite easy for us to attract those guys. And so basically it's like two magnets attracting each other, and we find those guys quite easily, and they find us quite easily as well. So that kind of worked out. In terms of communicating the value to the organization, I think basically that's what you say and that's what you do. So I think every decision we make internally, when we make those decisions, the decision process is quite transparent to most of the people in our team. So when we make those decisions, our philosophy is, okay, are we protecting our users? Are we doing the right thing? And we ask that question all the time, and we make decisions based on that. A lot of times we take a hit that other people don't know. And when you do that consistently, the team knows, the team trusts you. So the team gets a lot more exposure to my personalities or our leadership's personalities. So that value, so it's what you do that filters down. So, and the team, given their visibility to that trust, like there's very strong trust within the team. So that's also why most of the team take BNB as compensation. They know that BNB is good. So, so that's basically how I view kind of it works.
Absolutely. And so, you know, one of the things that, I think people would be upset, is this idea that you're able to communicate very well internally with those 400 employees, and they get to see you kind of day to day, the actions that you take along with the words that you say and kind of the values that you're pursuing, and the type of company that you aspire to build. But there's plenty of people who don't get to see that, right? And they're, I'll just put them in the category of like the detractors. And these are the people who they'll complain about everything from the listing fees to the transparency you guys have, to, you know, what you choose to list, the regulatory, you know, kind of avenues you choose, et cetera. What would kind of be your overarching message back to a lot of those detractors, and maybe something that they don't know or kind of, you know, if you were talking with them that you would want them to understand?
Sure, sure. So I think there's, in terms of like the detractors you mentioned, there's a few different groups of those guys. There are guys who just honestly don't understand what we do, or don't know us that well, or they haven't followed our news, they didn't watch what we do. So for most people who's kind of know our history, watched us from day one, or watched us for a period of time, they kind of get it. They kind of understand. So that's part, and there are limitations on the amount of information we can disclose. For example, our listing process. If we fully disclose that, people will engineer that. And we change that all the time anyway, so we don't follow one standard process. At the end of the day, we just want to list good coins, and that's very generic. And how much value do we put on number of users or product or the token economics? It's very hard to say. So, and it changes all the time. And how much listings fees do we charge? Well, it changes in every case actually as well. So, as a business, we keep a lot of that. Binance.com is a centralized private business, so we keep a lot of those information internally because we also don't want our competitors to know. We also have other pressures from other directions. So there are certain parts of the business we can't fully disclose because if we have no competitors, we have no risks, and yes, then we can do that. But it's a little bit difficult. And there's a second category of distractors, which are basically guys who I would say have some deficiencies on their own. They are either jealous or they feel entitled. So a lot of guys feel that they are entitled to be listed on Binance for free. I'm like, well, no, not necessarily. That's not how the world works. In a decentralized, freedom-driven world, you do what you do, we do what we do. We have all the right to charge a listing fee if you want to. We also have the right not to charge it if we don't want to. So, and even if we don't charge a listing fee for a coin, let's say we never charge a listing fee for Ethereum or Bitcoin, but we may charge a listing fee for your project. So there's a lot of those kind of things where people feel entitled and they feel that the world should work in a certain way, but actually the world doesn't work that way, especially in a freedom-driven world. So some of those guys, we can't really help. They really just need to come to an understanding of how the world really works and that freedom is freedom. And some guys even get offended when I block them on Twitter, right? So like the guy's talking shit. I just don't want to be bothered. I block the guy. I don't need to hear what he says. And he says, well, now I'm violating his freedom of speech. I'm like, wait a second, you can still speak. I just have freedom to block you. There are those guys I can't help. So it is what it is.
Listen, I'm with you on a lot of the Twitter trolls. You and I probably get a good handful of them, and some of them you can kind of put up with and just say, you know, kind of ignore, but every once in a while somebody crosses the line, and frankly it's better for you to block them, so I fully understand that.
Yeah.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about kind of how you see the world, right? Because you're the CEO of one of the most important pieces of infrastructure in the global crypto ecosystem, right? And I think a lot of people see what you're doing on a day-to-day basis, but understanding your mindset or your view of the world will help them better think about crypto. Right. And so sure. One of the big differentiations is between these utility token and like cryptocurrencies, things that I'll say are not as heavily regulated versus like tokenized securities. Maybe talk through, at a high level, the difference, how you view them. And then if there's certain jurisdictions around the world where you think that tokenized securities will kind of get adopted first, just given the kind of regulatory compliance that is easier to do in certain jurisdictions.
Sure. So that's actually a very good question, and it's very broad. So I'll try to stab at a few different places. I think in terms of a utility versus security token, that's a sort of a very much man-made distinction. Again, as you said, different parts of the world regulate them differently. Well, some parts of the world don't even have regulations for some of that stuff. The concept is very different from from different places. But I think fundamentally, a token or a coin should have value based on utility. So that's how you use it. It may be that it represents value in a company share or something that will be closer to a security. I personally think security tokens probably going to take off faster where the regulations are more relaxed. So in countries where there's very heavy and very strong regulations on securities, I think it's probably going to take off slower because there's just more work involved in moving through those very rigid structures. And I think also cryptocurrency, even tokens, that kind of represents, basically we talk about tokenizing everything in the world. And when you're tokenizing everything, many of those things will look like a security because they will represent certain shares in certain things. But I think fundamentally, cryptocurrency probably should not be classified as securities, to be honest, because cryptocurrency does a lot more than what traditional securities do, because now you can transfer them on a blockchain. So if you use the traditional sort of security tokens model, then now you have to do whitelisting the smart contracts of addresses of approved accredited investors, et cetera, then it's still better than a piece of paper. The blockchain is still better than a piece of paper. But then you severely limit the growth of that that new tool. So I think in countries where they're more relaxed about this kind of thing, okay, so you can tokenize a building or you can tokenize land, tokenize real estate, as you probably have a couple projects involved in that area. Then in countries where the regulations are more relaxed, as long as you're not a scam, as long as you have real estate that's being tokenized, then people are free to trade it more freely. Then you get a lot more liquidity. You get a lot more market cap. So and then you get a lot more funds, and you will be able to grow faster. So I think in that aspect, I think in the early stages of the industry, the regulation should try to prevent bad actors, but not limit the industry growth. So I think that's very key. And in terms of jurisdictions and sort of my kind of worldview of what we're doing with Binance. Right now, I think it's very clear that most of the money is still in fiat. So we need to somehow build bridges so that to let those money flow more freely into the crypto world. So that's why we're adding fiat on-ramps in different places. So that's why we're doing Jersey, Uganda, Singapore, Malta, many other places. And that's also why we enable credit card payments through a third party. And there's more. We are also exploring or at least researching debit card integrations and other things. So there's a lot more to come. So we want to build a fiat on-ramp so that we can allow fiat to come into our world of crypto. And then on the flip side, of course, we have right now Binance.com is a centralized crypto-to-crypto exchange. So we are also building or releasing the Binance Dex, the decentralized exchange we have. So we're trying to explore on both sides. And then we have the Launchpad, which I firmly believe is a very, very important part of our ecosystem, which is we want to help entrepreneurs to raise money and to be able to better develop our ecosystem and every other ecosystem as well. So I think fundraising is a killer app of blockchain. Fundraising is a killer app of blockchain. And we kind of slowed down a little bit in 2018 due to the market correction, due to a large number of projects didn't work out. People are still trying to get used to that, and some scams and fraudsters involved. Once people learn how those things work, once people learn how to deal with that, I'm almost 100% sure that blockchain fundraising will be back. It is a killer app for a blockchain, and we should help it. And once we do that, we're going to help the entrepreneurs very strongly in our space, and to some extent in traditional industries as well. And I think helping entrepreneurs is one of the strongest things to help ecosystems economies grow. So I come from an entrepreneurial background, so I really want to help other entrepreneurs. And I think entrepreneurs are the guys who's going to make the world change into a better place. So so that's kind of my worldview. And we're navigating a very complex world right now with 100 different sets of regulations or different sets of rules that we made up for ourselves. We just want to be very cognizant of that and respect every rule that's out there. I'm never a revolution kind of guy. I'm not extremely libertarian like many crypto people are. I'm not against any government, any individual, any company, any organization. I just want to improve things a little bit at a time. So I'm not trying to remove banks. I'm not trying to revolutionize against them. I just want to provide a different alternative that's potentially has different a set of characteristics or advantages, and let people adopt. And some of those things will work, some of those things will not, and the market will choose. So that's kind of my worldview.
Yeah, what are the things that, you know, as you and I have talked more and spent a little bit of time together in Singapore, that frankly I was surprised is your approach to a lot of the decisions you make. Not only are one rational and obviously you're a smart guy who a lot of people believe in, you'd be able to build this, you know, fairly large company, but also your approach to regulation is quite sober, right? You aren't kind of storming the hill, if you will, with pitchforks, right? You're saying, look, what are the rules there? Let's try to operate within those rules and understand that old kind of, you know, the historic kind of frameworks that have been applied to some of this stuff may not be perfect, but let's do as little as we can to disrupt that, right? Let's not try to step on toes. Let's not try to kind of piss people off you know, get in the way of regulators or do things they don't want you to do. And I wish that more people kind of saw that side. Because I think it's pretty commendable, one, and two, frankly, it's counterintuitive to what, you know, many from the outside see.
Sure. Absolutely. I think many people have a different, I don't know, for whatever reason, have a different set of beliefs in how we operate. I personally am not, I'm a very practical kind of guy. So I like to understand how the world really works and figure out what we can do in the world to make things better. And I'm not like kind of idealistic or philosophical that we have to make the world work in this way. So even though I have a set of philosophical beliefs on what's the best, but practically what we can do, we got to be very programmatic about it. So I'm always thinking in those kind of ways. So far, Binance actually have never had any run-ins with anybody. Contrary to what people believe, so we actually. We're actually just trying to find solutions to make things better. That's all we do.
For sure. And you know, two of the parts of the business that you didn't talk about yet, Binance Labs and then the charity work. Maybe give a little overview of what you guys are doing there and why you're spending so much time and resources, you know, building those two functions out.
Sure. I'll talk a little about Binance Charity first. So there is a little bit of a self-serving aspects to the philanthropy work, I think. Using charity, social impact work to push crypto is the best way, or one of the best ways for people to adopt crypto. And when people receive a donation in crypto, they have to learn it. They have to learn how to use a wallet. They have to learn how to exchange it. And then they have to learn what is Bitcoin, what is Binance Coin, what is Binance, what is this wallet. So I think that's the best way to educate. I think there's more value in educating that person than giving them $10 in crypto. So, and that will help. And that's when you have that kind of positive experience as the first interaction with crypto, that basically gets imprinted into your mind or subconsciousness. And then crypto is a good thing. So I think if you can do that consistently, a little bit at a time, if you just build that habit, and eventually it's gonna add up. 10 years later, the next generation of people who grow up will like crypto. So they will not have the same kind of misconceptions or concerns as we do about crypto as some of the people from today. And it's a great way to spread to educate the industry. And we also, of course, at the same time, we're doing a really good thing. We're doing social impact work. That's really satisfying. And it's very good that we're able to do that this early stage in the organization's journey. Binance Labs is an investment arm. So basically, there's many good projects, there's many things out there that's really good that we are not experts in, or at least I'm not experts in. So for example, wallets, other faster blockchains. So there's a lot of stuff out there that I'm not an expert in. And there are other people building those projects. So this way, we want to find them early and we want to fund them. We want to give them money so that we want to invest so that they have a healthy platform to grow on. So Binance Labs and Binance Launchpad and even the listing process of Binance are three core pillars that we will want to help entrepreneurs and new coins, new projects to grow. So we could invest in them. We can help them raise money through Launchpad. And then we can list them to help them, give them liquidity, give them access to more users. So all of these things we do. And so Binance Labs, we make investments. We also do incubation programs. We just launched a fellowship program where you don't have to really have a project or we don't have to invest in, but we can give you a grant. We can give you like and there's no strings attached. We can give you like, I don't know, a couple thousand dollars or for a few months or so. And you can go away and do your project. And there's no strings attached. We just want to help you build out the industry. So that's kind of what we do in those areas.
Got it. And then are there other things that you're thinking about now in terms of building out other like divisions of Binance? Or do you think you'll just continue to invest in the ones you've got right now, and then maybe in the future you can expand even further?
I think Binance right now probably has enough sub teams or divisions on the coverage. So I don't think we're going to add a lot more. To be honest, I actually think we're doing too much. I actually want to do less. But the organization is decentralized. It's already spread out. So I can't really centralize them right now. But I think we're doing enough in terms of the number of initiatives. I think we want to go deeper in each initiative and do them well.
The Binance virus is spreading and it's out of control.
Thanks. The virus is always spreading.
Exactly. So let's talk a little bit more big picture, right? Is there anything that you guys are not doing today that you would like to do in the future, right? Not necessarily like new divisions, but just whether it's operating in certain jurisdictions, if it's adding certain types of assets, like what is kind of the bigger, larger picture for Binance right now from the CEO's seat?
Sure. I think, as you said, I think there's a lot of different jurisdictions we don't cover, don't service, or there's no coverage by anybody. We want to cover those jurisdictions so that we can help those people get into crypto or get into the blockchain ecosystem. So there's so many jurisdictions in the world, and I'm always asking my team, can you research this country, this place, and give me a list of things where places where we should be next. And on the product side, so very obviously, we don't have margin, we don't have futures. So those things will probably come later. security tokens, there's a few experiments run by different projects. We want to see how that market shakes up. We have licenses in a number of jurisdictions for that already. But honestly, we don't know how to use those licenses. Basically, we don't know what we can or cannot do. Given Binance's impact, we actually want other smaller exchanges to try it first. Because with Binance, if we try something bad or something that's kind of steps on somebody else's toe, the impact will be large and the reaction will be large as well. So we kind of want to avoid that. Other than that, I think we have enough work on our plate, and let's just, we don't have to cover everything. What we want to do is we want to be the infrastructure player for a few things out of many, and we want to do them well. So for exchanges, definitely our core business. Decentralized exchanges, if that industry takes off, we want to be there. Fiat exchanges, less important, but I think right now it's important. It's just for the transition period. So that's kind of our view.
For sure. And one of those things that you personally, I think, have done a great job of is the way that you use Twitter, right? You really communicate well whenever there's, you know, maintenance or a security issue or anything like that. Maybe talk a little bit about like why you spend time doing that. You know, your time is valuable. You've got a bunch of employees. You could be doing a whole bunch of other things. But why spend so much time kind of communicating with customers that way and other people who are interested in what you're doing?
Sure, sure. Well, just let me say first, on how to use Twitter, I'm always trying to learn from you. I think you're one of the best guys on Twitter. Your way of communication, of like just precise presentation communication, is just awesome. So I'm always trying to learn from you on that. And how you handle Twitter is great. So for me personally, I really like to interact with our community and with our users and with what we call Binantians. So in the early days, I was using we were using WeChat, but it only allows 500 people, up to 500 people in a group. And then we switched over to like Slack, and Slack has some security issues with spam bots and stuff like that. So then we switched to I don't know what else. We tried so many different things. Eventually, we're now using Telegram as well. But Telegram groups go up to like 100,000. Now they go up to 200,000. Whatever you type on screen doesn't stay there for like half a second, especially when I'm in here. People get excited, CZ's in here, and the screen just starts scrolling like crazy. So I find Twitter is actually the best platform where I can interact with a number of random people, but also a number of set people that I follow. And the interaction is a little bit random because I don't see all the tweets that's tweeted at me. But I see a portion of them, and I just respond when I respond. And so I think that's kind of worked it well because, number one, it allows me to learn what our users think, what our community think, if there's a big problem, or if there are training problems, training complaints. Right now, there's big demand for OCOs and like a new order type. Before, there was a lot of demand for XRP base pair. So I kind of get a direct feedback that way. And I also get feedback on how our team's doing, even though without the mentioned direct teams. And also, I think the community appreciates that. So I try to spend somewhere between 10 to 20% of my time interacting with the community. And then the other 80% or so I spend internally with the team or with doing other random stuff. So that's kind of how I allocate my time. And on Twitter, I don't view myself as a Twitter expert, but what I do is very simple. I just be myself. So whenever I do a speech, get on stage or get on Twitter or interact with somebody, I just say, be yourself. So sometimes I do stupid stuff. I yell at, I call people, or I even use profanity sometimes. But I just be myself. And if that works, that works. If that doesn't, that's still myself. So there's really no choice. So that's,
yeah, look, I think people appreciate your authenticity.
I think so. I think I'm one of the, I don't see many other CEOs, especially for exchanges, doing what I'm doing. But I'm okay with it. I just do my thing, and looks like it's kind of working. So I haven't got into any big problems.
Absolutely. One of the things that I'm personally interested in is, you know, why are you doing all this, right? What's kind of personally driving you to continue to, you know, I always tell you, you're pushing the pace, right? You're pushing the pace in terms of features that you're launching, the speed at which you guys are building, the number of assets that you're bringing online, the jurisdictions that you go into. Like, what is your personal motivation to do all of this?
I think it's just to have a more fulfilling life, right? It's just that I think you want to make the best out of your life. I mean, basically, we're on this earth for about, I don't know, a couple of decades. I don't know, 50, 100 years or so. So I think basically, I asked myself, right? So what do I want to do? Do I want to relax on the beach and sipping martinis all day long? I'll get bored like in 5 hours or less. And that's just not fun. Do I want to drive a sports car? No, it's not fun. So I'm not interested in those kind of stuff. So I think basically today, I can relatively confidently say that I can take care of myself relatively okay on most fronts. Some places I do need other people's help, etc. So I'm still a social animal. And then I think for me or for humans in general, the way I figured it out is to have the most meaningful life is actually just to do something impactful. I think as a species, we're genetically engineered so that you take care of yourself first, and then you want to take care of help others. I think that's the most rewarding thing to do as a species. So if we don't do that, if we're not genetically engineered that way, then our species probably would not exist. So the most rewarding thing for me to do is find a way to help others. And if my abilities are stronger, then I'll do more. If my abilities are weaker, I'll just do my little bit that I can do. So it's whatever I can do. Honestly, I have enough money, and doubling it or taking half away of it is not going to change my life very, very much. So that doesn't drive me. So I think basically at the end of the day, what drives me is to be able to make a positive impact. And that's really meaningful. And the best thing I know how to do is basically increase adoption of crypto. I think that's going to be the most positive impact I can bring to our species. So it sounds a little bit arrogant, but that's kind of honestly what I think. And and then in terms of the speed of pushing things out, you do your best, and then you try to challenge yourself a little bit, right? So I think as humans, we feel most satisfied if we do things that's a little bit challenging, but not overly challenging to ourselves. So we always want to push ourselves a little bit, and so we keep pushing. So we're always competing with ourselves. So we keep pushing the pace a little bit, doing the fastest we can while ensuring security and quality. And things just happen. So I think, honestly, given that's kind of my personality, the team inherits quite a lot of it. We have very little bullshit, very little politics, very little, sometimes even communication going on in the team. But we just get stuff done. We're very results-driven. So we just get stuff done and we ignore everything else. So that it kind of works. It works quite well.
I love it. All right. Before we end this, though, I want to do a quick kind of rapid fire of questions. And when asked a question, you just fire away with whatever comes to mind. What is what's the most important book that you've ever read?
Yes, I actually did prepare for this one because I listened to your podcast before. So contrary to my early answer, I would say the book I recommend very highly is actually called The Law by Frederick Bastiat. I think it's written in 1850. So it's written more than 150, 170 years ago. But it's still there, still around, still being printed. So people should read it. And that's what The Law should be describing that book. I believe that book's very strongly. And I think when you read that, you understand how our world works better. There's a couple other books, if I can squeeze in there, I would recommend. Economics in One Lesson by Henry something. I apologize, I forgot the author's full name. That book is kind of an extension of the law, but it talks more about economics, where there's very fundamental, basic concept of economics that makes total sense by that book, but that's a totally misunderstood by, I would say, majority of our population. So people you got to understand how the world works. And so Economics in One Lesson is a book I strongly recommend. Those two books are very good, yeah.
And I've never heard of The Law, so I'm going to have to go read that one.
It's a very short book. It's very good. I'll tweet you the link later. There's actually a third book, which I would really recommend as well, which is Sapiens by Homo Sapiens, a short history of humankind or something. Again, I forgot the author's full name. But again, when you read that book, you understand how humans work, how we evolved, how we made, what emotions we have, how do we think, how different structures of our societies work through history. Basically, you understand how we work, which is very important. I think to be successful, you got to understand how the world works and how we work. So I think those books are very, very helpful.
For sure. All right. I usually end with letting you ask me one question, but before we do that, we got to talk about aliens. What's the what is the probability that aliens exist?
So this is a very interesting topic. I believe almost 100%, basically 99.99999% that aliens do exist. What does that look like is very variable, but they could look similar to us and being able to communicate, interact with us. They could also be aliens who are on totally different dimensions that with us that we can't really interact with. I think both exist. And out on that topic, we could open a whole different can of worms. I also believe in simulation theory, the fact that basically we live in a simulation. I'll kind of also believe in that. But anyway, so we can have a little bit sometime.
CZ, man, I knew I liked you. I knew you were going to believe in aliens.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
Amazing. All right, to finish it up, what one question do you have for me?
So I have a more of a fun question, to be honest. So congratulations on the recent fundraising on your fund. I have a question about that. I heard through the grapevines that you have a police pension fund investing in you as well.
Yes, there is a it is a public police pension in a county in Virginia in the United States.
That is awesome. Congratulations. That's my question. I think that's my question.
Yeah, look, it's interesting because I think a lot of people, there's been this narrative of like the institutions are coming, right? We've been hearing that since like end of 2017, early 2018. And last year in 2018, we did get a kind of a first look at what that might look like in that, you know, Yale, MIT, Notre Dame, Stanford, Harvard, a bunch of endowments came in. And some of them very small checks, some a little bit more meaningful checks, but it was pretty much contained to the endowments. Then the other data point that we had was the Singaporean government, right? They actually invested in you guys.
Yes.
And so that was kind of another institutional type investor, you know, putting money into the crypto ecosystem. But we wanted to raise a fund and really focus on institutions. And so the fund that we announced is anchored by two public pensions, and then it also has an endowment, a hospital system, an insurance company, et cetera. And, you know, frankly, it's funny to hear a lot of what you're talking about because they really do believe in a lot of the, like, every stock, bond, currency, and commodity is going to be digital or tokenized, right? There's going to be this new digital world that has less focus on borders. Across the institutional world, you see them buying into a world of like automation and machine-to-machine transactions. And so going into a venture fund where you can own equity in these businesses in this industry is a little bit less risky for them than, say, just buy Bitcoin or BNB or whatever.
Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, this is a nice first step. And then hopefully over time, more institutions will follow them and go into the liquid side. The other thing that I will say is, the police pension, it's funny to me personally, because while everyone is yelling and screaming about, you know, criminals use this stuff, bad people use this stuff, right? I think that those that are closest to crime, like law enforcement, whether it's at the federal level, the state level, or the local level, they realize that bad people do bad things regardless of the industry,
right? Yeah.
There's people doing bad things on Wall Street. There's people doing bad things in crypto. There's people doing bad things with Bitcoin. And there's people doing bad things with the US dollar, right? And so it's less about, you know, the dollar being bad or Bitcoin being bad or the industry. And it's much more about let's go find the bad people and make them stop. And then let's allow innovation to thrive, right? So I think there's a lot actual overlap between the way that you see what you guys are doing and kind of building the company and the way that these institutional investors see the world. And so hopefully we'll just have more of them come into the space.
Sure, absolutely. I mean, that's awesome. And it reminds me of the movie or the TV series Billions. I didn't watch much of the series, but the episode I watched was the police fund investing in the funds. So now you're doing that.
I have to admit, I've seen it, and I did not think that people were going to make that reference. And of course, Twitter is undefeated. They literally at 6 a.m. this morning started tweeting photos of the Billions characters, and so I got a good laugh out of that.
Right, right. And also, just one more clarification. It's not that I gotta say this so that my investors doesn't get on me. It's not the Singapore government that investing in us. It's the Vertex, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Temasek, which is basically a Singapore sovereign fund that investing in Binance. Uh-huh. But again, it is a very sort of a government related type of fund. That's reinvesting in us.
So it's related. Just the structure is a little different.
Yeah. So I just want to make that clear so that we don't have any, guys cheering.
No, you got it. Yeah. All right. Listen, man, I appreciate everything you're doing. I think that, there's a lot of people who use your service every day. You obviously are employing a ton of people, and you are one of the entrepreneurs that is at the forefront of this industry. And so just keep going and let me know however we can help. I'm cheering for you.
Thank you so much, Pam. And you've been an inspiration in our industry and for me as well. So, we talk to each other. Well, we see each other on Twitter all the time. Let's keep the conversation going. And good luck with the fund. If you need any help, let me know.
You got it, sir.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, guys. I appreciate listening to that episode. I enjoyed it and I hope you did too. Before we go, I want to remind you that it was brought to us by The Grove, a full-service creative and design agency that has worked with companies like Block, Chamber of Digital Commerce, AAA, and the American Red Cross. You can check out more of their work at thegrove.co/pomp. Again, that's .co and not .com. thegrove.co/pomp. Go check it out and let me know what you think.
Hey everyone, Pomp here. If you like this episode of Off the Chain and want to help us take crypto to the top of the Apple, Spotify, and other podcast charts, please do us a favor and rate, review, and subscribe. To review, simply go to the Off the Chain homepage, scroll down until you see the 5 blank stars. Taking 15 seconds to fill those stars in and leave a quick review goes a long way in helping us take the entire crypto ecosystem to the top of the charts. I appreciate you listening and see you next time on Off the Chain.